The Guardian.
Football Weekly. Weekend of upsets, midweek of drama. 1 year on from riots, Tottenham again gets burnt by arson as Wenger triumphs in North London derby. It's Handy Carrow as leaders Man United are latest big side humbled in Norwich. If only they'd flown there. And out of my arse, will those be the words Tony Fernandez tells Mark Hughes when he returns from Texas? We round up the weekend, preview Chelsea, Juve, Benfica, Celtic and the other Champions League game, get the latest from around Europe and talk music and football in this Football Weekly. Hi everybody, and off we go then on another Football Weekly adventure into football. Amy Lawrence with a lovely smile.
Hello.
Hi Amy. Greg Bukowski.
Hi James.
Serious.
Serious, yeah.
Serious, right. And here's Barry Glendenning.
Hello James, have you recovered?
Yeah, yes. From?
The hatchet job Sean Ingle did on you in yesterday's Observer.
Shocking. Shocking. Barry.
Yes.
Winnings, Barry Glendenning. This tweet from you, not predicting Sunderland will win 9-2, they'll win 3-1. You posted this on Saturday evening. What happened at Craven Cottage?
Sunderland won 3-1.
That's extraordinary.
It was kind of obvious it was going to happen.
Was it? They had had, let me quote this
They
to
hadn't
you.
Won away from home in 18 matches.
Right, they had 15 shots on target in 10 league games. That is the lowest in any of Europe's top five leagues. How did you get them winning 3-1?
Algorithms. Special mathematical. I copied the formula used by that guy who predicted all 50 states in the US election and it just 3-1 came up.
Wow. And how much did you put on?
On the score being 3-1?
Nothing.
Not a penny.
What did you have on Arsenal Spurs, if I may ask?
Nothing, not a penny.
All right, but what did you feel? Did you have a feeling about that one, eh? Hmm?
I kind of thought Arsenal would win it, and they did. But obviously we've all been indoctrinated to believe that it could have gone the other way if Manuel Adebayor hadn't been sent off, because he would have single-handedly stopped Arsenal scoring.
Are you suggesting that wasn't the turning point of the game? Amy, what do you think about that?
I'm inclined to agree with Barry. I think
really?
There was obviously it affected the game, but I think it's a little bit casual to suddenly assume that the entire events hinged on that particular incident. And I think if you look at Tottenham's shape when Adebayor got sent off, bearing in mind they were a goal ahead, it didn't affect the back half of their team remotely. They just lost a striker, but carried on playing exactly the same way, supposedly, as regards to the way that they were set up. Promptly conceded three goals and got absolutely hammered before half time. But they adjusted in the second half as regards to their tactics and made a much better fist of it. But I just don't see that it's a certainty that Tottenham wouldn't have caved in again anyway, regardless of who was on the pitch.
Okay, so what was the difference? The headed goal from Mertesacker?
Well, I think that paved the way, but there were two particular players for Arsenal, and I'm especially intrigued by young Theo Walcott, who I think was instrumental in the tide turning slightly. And Theo he's been a player who's divided opinion for such a long time at Arsenal. And I think in his early years, you gave him the benefit of the doubt for being quite maddeningly inconsistent. But, you know, whether it's got anything to do with his contract soon coming up is purely a subject for debate. But something seems to have clicked with him this year. And I think there's a lot of talk about whether he wants to play as a more central position. And obviously when he played wide, Chris Waddle summed it up by repeatedly talking about how he didn't have a football brain and tended to make the wrong decisions. But it seems to me he's now able to make the right decisions a lot more and affect the game in such a positive way. And he was really, really excellent. And in the summer, when he had a year to go, and the obvious thing would be, I think Arsenal were not making a secret of the fact that they were probably inviting suitors. A lot of people wouldn't have been that upset had he been sold. But I think now he's played himself into a position where people will be quite upset if he goes.
Really? Mm. I find it hard to imagine him exciting emotion in any sense, Theo Walcott. Nice chap, though, he undoubtedly seems to be. But are you not a little bit worried about getting excited about this?
I don't think anyone's getting overexcited about it. In fact, a lot of people I was talking to at the end were very conscious of the fact that this shouldn't be papering over cracks. And nobody would be sane if they thought that Arsenal's problems were fixed by that. But that doesn't mean you don't enjoy a North London derby victory if it comes your way.
Absolutely right.
Defending with 10 men isn't hugely more difficult than defending with 11. Rennes held on to a 2-1 lead against Paris Saint-Germain with 9 men away from home for 40 minutes on Saturday. It can be done.
I'd say from I saw the second half, or was it a breastfeeding class before for the first half. Yeah, obviously, big man that I am. But I did see the second half. I managed to get to the pub in time, and I thought Santi Cazorla, you know, played very well for Arsenal again, and his cleverness as an attacking midfielder kind of brought the best out of Walcott, and he was finding the runs that he was going, you know, in the channels as well. But that's what I've got to offer, you know.
Wow, it was an extraordinary afternoon you had.
Yeah, it
light
was.
And shade, yeah. Yin and yang in the real sense.
Yeah, very much so. I had to have a doll. I had to practice with a doll, which is...
Why are you practicing?
Thanks for asking, Barry.
I really wanted to.
Yeah, I honestly don't know.
I don't think it's unguardian to ask a man what he's doing at a breastfeeding class.
Well...
Apart from giving moral support, yeah, you seem to have been very hands-on.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be just moral support.
Maybe that's where he went.
Yeah, well... And it turned out that that I had to actually put the doll in certain positions on myself, and then show Anna how to do it. Honestly, I don't know. It's like something out of a Nick Hornby novel or something.
Right.
You know, particularly painful.
All right, Amy, you're uniquely positioned to actually tell us about this. Greg, with breastfeeding, can you give him any tips? Could he give you any tips?
I was all right, thanks. I don't really need tips, but as regards giving you tips, Greg, I think there are certain ways of holding the bottle that might help, but the whole breastfeeding gig with dolls, I fail to see quite what the purpose of you being told to do that is.
I love the way we're talking about Spurs and Arsenal playing a football match, and Greg says him breastfeeding is the thing you'd find in the Nick Hornby novel.
I wonder if Adebayor would have anything to
offer on breastfeeding. I don't know. There maybe various tip comparisons you could make if you were an Arsenal.
But you're supposed to have a higher IQ if you've breastfed as a baby. So I'm guessing Adebayor didn't, given what he did.
Right. Well, yeah, it was a ridiculous challenge, and we're back on track. Okay. Meantime, Spurs are going to be away at Lazio in the Europa League Thursday. Big game that one. Hmm? Gaza derby, and then they have West Ham after that. Do you think he'll be continuing with the... Well, obviously he can't go with the 4-4-2 with West Ham, but in Europe, do you think he'll be going 4-4-2 in that? This new 4-4-2 André Villas-Boas? What do you think, Barry?
Well.
All right, then. Arsenal, in the meantime, will be at home to Montpellier. They've never beaten a French team at home.
Well, Arsenal are kind of a French team themselves.
Ah.
Except with slightly more bottle.
Right.
In big, important match. I think they'll win that game tomorrow.
Right.
And that hex will be lifted.
Yep.
On Wednesday.
Montpellier, not coming in the best of states. Obviously, they've had a rotten time since losing Olivier Giroud. They've drawn their last three in Ligue 1. Their last match was enlivened by one of their fullbacks slapping a journalist in the post-game mix zone. And Arsenal, of course, you know, they've got the bit between their teeth now, haven't they? Greg, you look to them to pile on the goals in this one.
Well, yeah, they've been scoring a lot of goals this season. It's just whether they can not pile them into their own goal at the other end. I mean, that's
really
ultimately, not score own goals,
right.
Is what I'm saying, but they have conceded a lot of goals this season, and it's getting that balance right between going forward and, you know, whacking seven in at one end and not conceding three or four at the other.
Right, okay. Well, Arsenal are now a mere 9 points off the top of the table because, of course, Man United lost at Norwich. Hey, they went behind, but this time they didn't come back. Greg, what do you reckon?
Well, I thought it was a very lethargic performance by Man United. I don't think Ferguson put his best team out to start with. I thought, you know, the usual issue in midfield with Giggs and Carrick, you know, it's not a very dynamic central partnership. But I just thought that what was interesting was that United had all, you know, they had a lot of possession, they started the game well, and they dominated. But most teams, when they lose possession... They become a little bit more energised to win the ball back. They seemed just as ponderous when they were without the ball as when they were with it. And I think that gave Norwich heart. They saw that United weren't, they weren't energetic, and they started to hit them on the counter attack, and they became more confident as the game went on.
Terrific goal from Pilkington, though. What a header that was.
It was a lovely header, yeah.
Beyond that, though, how did Norwich do this? How have they turned themselves around? I mean, they've picked up 5 clean sheets, I think, in their last 6 matches.
I think, well, I'd say maybe the turning point was when Liverpool went there and hammered them, and Chris Hughton probably took a good hard look at his team and started to get them more organised.
Right, was that just before the international break?
It was.
Because this is the story that apparently, because Norwich don't have too many internationals in their squad, while everybody else was waving goodbye to the beloved players at the airport, etc., he basically got the squad together for 6 or 7 days and just hammered them defensively day after day, and the result is this.
Yeah. It's a strange thing with United, though. I do think had they conceded that goal earlier, then perhaps that would have stung them into action. But they conceded it at like 65 minutes, and then they only had kind of 25 minutes to go gung-ho for the Norwich goal up until that point. Mm. It was quite a laboured performance.
Well, they could have actually tried scoring first on this occasion. That was another option, one for the future. Yeah. And anyway, City went top of the Premier League after their 5-0 win with Villa. Once again, let's talk turning points, Amy. That bizarre penalty decision.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like... I mean, City would probably have won that game regardless. It didn't really look like Villa were odds on to make a comeback anyway. Obviously, it was a very heavy scoreline for Villa to take on board, and it's... I don't know, it's just weird that you think City are somehow not convincing people, even after a 5-0 win, and there's something about that that feels strange.
It's because Mancini's gone. He's gone mentally. He turned up for a press conference with a David Platt mask on.
Is he going to wear a Mourinho mask?
Oh, I don't know. That would really mess with people. Also, I don't know if you saw this, but in other losing his marbles news, he actually didn't sit on the bench but sat on the concrete steps next to it. Oh, and
why is this a sign he's losing his marbles?
Come on, Barry. Come on. Join the dots. Yeah. The other week, half time, he sat all on his own on the Man City bench.
Maybe he just wanted a bit of peace and quiet.
Right. Or.
The thing I liked most about him turning up at the David Platt mask is whenever a manager like tries to do a funny at a press conference, all the journalists laugh much more loudly than the joke actually deserves. Hmm. It's just like, oh, this is the funniest thing we've ever seen.
Right. It's painful.
Craven, undeserved laughter.
Right.
I just
when he pulled it
that.
Off and showed it to Mancini. Imagine if he'd pulled that off as well and it really was David Platt all along. Like in Mission Impossible or something.
It's a bit unfair on David Platt as well, isn't it?
You know, what?
We're just making fun of him with his kind of big, ugly physic on the front.
Well, you're the one who's being unfair now, Greg.
Well, yeah, maybe.
Mm. Anyway, all sorts of exciting things we could talk about with Man City. They're hosting Real Madrid. Do they want to win this game? Do they want to get into the Europa League? Do they want to just get shot of Europe?
They just want a bit of pride back in Europe, don't they, I imagine? You know, it's just this is the kind of result that, even if they don't still qualify for the Champions League or the Europa League, will probably give them a lot of confidence, even just for the league campaign going on.
Mm. Anyway, there they are, 2 points clear at the top of the table, and all very exciting. We're going to take a quick musical interlude, and then we'll return with West Brom Chelsea and Dialing Up the Sid. Chelsea there at the Hawthorns. One side had a goal scorer, the other one didn't. Is that too simplistic, do you think, Greg?
Possibly too simplistic.
Really?
Yeah, but Fernando Torres is kind of he's gone back into his shell. He's hiding on the pitch again, and he's not playing particularly well. And the players who Di Matteo picked alongside him, you know, to give a go and to prove that they can do something, didn't really perform for him.
Didn't really perform.
Well, they didn't perform, but let's give a lot of credit to West Brom as well because
let's do that in a second. Let's first have a bit of a go at Daniel Sturridge. Big opportunity. What did he do with it?
He cocked it up.
Right.
I read somewhere, I don't know whether it was true or not, that he went over to throw his shirt into the crowd or something, and people were saying, "Oh, I don't want it," and he was getting a bit of dog's abuse, and that seems...
he probably would have missed, says producer Ben.
maybe Torres should wear his Latan mask, see if that makes a difference.
Well, I think Torres was wearing somebody's mask, because I didn't even notice he was on the pitch until he got taken off.
I was talking to producer Ben before and admitting in my shame that, you know, when you get a bit... You know you're getting old when you're falling asleep on the sofa during match of the day, and I was kind of half hazily aware of the West Brom Chelsea segment, and it was only the next day when I realised and looked at the paper that Torres was actually playing.
No, but I actually watched the game, not the I mean, it was the football first, but it was the full hour of it, and I thought, that's interesting, he's gone Sturridge and as a lone striker. Interesting. What's this? Torres being taken off?
I don't think it's a sign you're getting old if you're falling asleep on the sofa watch match of the day. It's just a sign you're watching match of the day.
Ah, dear. Now, yes.
I mean, hats off, though, to...
West Brom, exactly.
West Brom and Pedro and Rafa, because they were all over this on Thursday, saying West Brom are bound to win. And we said, nah, never happened.
Right.
It'll be ridiculous.
Listeners, Barry's being ironic.
But I think when you look at... I mean, we talk about the Norwich game before, yeah. And you look at Houghton and Clark were both managers that... it was quite easy to sit and be sceptical about before the start of the season. I remember sitting in another section of this very pod. Have you talked about this?
No. I was just going to go, I was just waving it at Greg, because his line is that it's the fact that they're not actually managers per se, more coaches.
Well, this is the thing, there's a lot of scepticism about Clark, and having a look at the signings West Brom have made, they had the technical director was Dan Ashworth, who's now got the England role, and he's obviously well respected. Maybe that's something to do with Hodgson. Maybe it is the fact that he's very good at that role. But I mean, he's made over the last 3 years, he's made some very good signings. I mean, he brought Odin Wingy in for free, Tamás for free. I mean, he was probably the person who brought in Shane Long as well. That's 6.5 million the most he's spent. The net spend has been 4 million over
how
three
much
seasons.
Jakob was unbelievably cheap as well, wasn't he?
Jakob, he was free as well from Racing Santander.
That cheap, right.
Was
Shane Long for tracksuits or not?
I don't know about that. No, possibly. 8.75 million is what that starting lineup cost that beat Chelsea. And I think maybe they've looked at the players he had and thought, we've got a decent squad here. If we can bring a coach in who can go one better than Hodgson did with them, and he did particularly
exactly
well.
The point you're saying, we're going to bring in a coach who's going to do better than Hodgson, and people didn't, assuming that Steve Clark was that man, it was quite a big assumption. I mean, certainly, I'm not shy to admit that I thought that was a bit on the over bold side of bold. And the same thing with Houghton. You looked at him and you thought, how are you going to replicate that chemistry that Paul Lambert had with those Norwich players? And they've not massively changed the playing staff in either club, and yet these new guys have come in with quite a lot to prove, and in both cases actually almost managing to improve in some cases on what's happened the season before. And I can't compliment either of them enough at this stage.
Is there some suggestion that their calendar's been the fixtures so far have been a little bit favourable?
Well, when you think that Norwich have beaten Arsenal and Man United at home, that favourable? I don't know.
I
don't think that's the kind of result that they were doing very often for the last 2 decades.
All right, we stop.
Sorry, James.
Next, then, for West Brom, I'm not sure who they've got next, but Chelsea, Barry, have got Juventus midweek, and then Man City at the weekend. Let's talk about that Juve game.
Well, their record in Italy is not good. They've only won one of their last eight, I think, against Lazio about...
ages ago,
nine years ago.
That was Mutu and all that, and lost his spitting business and stuff.
I think they've lost four, drawn three of their other eight visits. They need a draw minimum, and that's probably what they'll play for, which is always a dangerous tactic.
It was 2-2 when they met at Stamford Bridge. Oscar with his incredible brace, but Juve arguably the better team. Juve, though, have drawn all their group games until the last one when they were playing against Norwich Zeeland and they got 4-0. But they do have a real lack of firepower, and we saw that again this weekend when they drew 0-0 with Lazio, a game in which Lazio failed to have a single shot on target, but Juve just couldn't put it away. Vucinic, their big goals threat, but he's had flu and is a major doubt for the game. Giovinco a little bit on the wee side. And, well, Quagliarella, he would be the fella, but we shall see. Pirlo?
They've Nicholas Bentner.
Yeah, that's very, very true, Barry. Very true.
He's only got, like, 6 or 7 outings for them, though, this season. Six of them as a sub, so...
When you look at the fixtures, though, Chelsea really probably only need a draw, and that was the real bonus of getting that win against Shakhtar Donetsk.
Yeah.
Because if they can get the draw in Juventus, you'd imagine that Chelsea will be all right against Norwich Zeeland in the final group game, whereas Juve have got to go to Shakhtar.
Right. But this game, for example, against West Brom, had they had a decent finisher up front, they had a lot of chances. I mean, they had plenty of opportunities to win that game. Is the problem him not making enough substitutions, or is it just the fact that they're playing fine, they just don't have anyone to put the ball in the net?
Well, I mean, possibly you could say that. I mean, there's a lot of teams that would argue we had lots of chances and didn't, score the goals required, but if that's not working, perhaps there is a reason for it.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Is it not just falling into that trap of thinking you've just had an international break, you've got a big week coming up with the Champions League, sort of hard away trip to Juventus and then Manchester City, this is the game where we're going to rotate. But I think that's a sign of the Premier League, that you can't go away from home and rotate. You can do that a little bit easier in your home matches, but I think it's a bit too audacious to think you can go away from home and make, you know, fairly big changes to the people that you're hoping are going to score you your goals.
All right. You're underestimating especially the power of the Baggies. Now into fourth place. Juve, just to mention, Pirlo missed out the weekend, so he will be very rested for this game. Be interesting to see if Chelsea managed to restrict him the way they did back in the first game. Barry, predictings of Barry Glendening? What's going to happen?
I don't know.
Oh, my word. What did the algorithm say?
I haven't looked.
What does the Amy say?
Score draw.
Really? Greg?
2-1 Juve.
2-1 Juve. Why not, eh? That'll really set up an incandescent finale to this group. Sid Lowe joins us now on the line from Spain. Sid.
Hello, James.
It's not your butcher or a grocer. It's us.
Brilliant. I'm pleased to know that. Although I would quite like that steak if you can arrange it for me.
Absolutely. Spanish steaks, of course, controversial pieces of meat, as cycling fans will be all too aware.
Isn't that brilliant, by the way? The greatest of excuses of all time. Blame it on the meat.
On the meat, yeah. The greatest doping excuse was possibly Marco Borriello's, who was done for some banned substance, and he got his girlfriend to claim that it was actually in a cream that she'd been using to clear up some personal affliction in an intimate area that then got passed on to him. And the court took a dim view of this, sadly. Anyway, now, Real Madrid there in Manchester, they had a big 5-1 win against Athletic Bilbao. It's all systems go, is it, for Mourinho's men again?
Yeah, they were really very good. I mean, it's difficult to judge it because Athletic Bilbao are disastrous at the back, and it was a game where I always expected a lot of goals. To be honest, I probably expected a couple from Athletic as well. Madrid scored 5. Cristiano Ronaldo didn't score any of them, and Madrid played really, really well, and they could have got 10 or 12. And it was interesting talking to one of Madrid's players afterwards about Athletic, so that, you know, this is still a team that runs like madmen absolutely everywhere, but it now feels like they don't know where to run, whereas in the past it was all so much better organised, much more regimented the way that they move, and it's as if they've kind of lost control.
Wow. All right. What about Seville, the derby there?
Oh, woof.
Yeah.
That really was a woof. I mean, it was just bonkers. It, by the way, it underlines one of the things that I mean, you know, every now and again I like to have a rant, as you know. One of the things that sums up how stupid the organisation of Spanish football is. This year, to try and make sure none of the games overlap, they've obviously set up a series of different timetables for games over the course of the weekend, so that you can, if you buy the subscription to the correct channels, you can watch every single game and they don't overlap. Let's see if you can see the slight flaw in this plan, Jimbo. Last night's games, or Sunday's games rather, 12 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5:50, 7:45, and 9:30. Now, these people don't seem to know how long a football match lasts. So anyone who was watching Granada Atletico Madrid, by the time they turned to the Seville derby, Sevilla Betis, had already missed 2 goals.
You're
Sevilla
kidding.
Already 2-0 up. José Antonio Reyes got the first one. After 12 seconds, it's the fifth fastest goal of all time. And no one in his team had touched the ball yet. It was brilliant. So Betis take the centre. One pass, very nice. Another pass, very nice. To another man, another pass, very nice. Back it goes to the goalkeeper. Nice pass from him. Oops, straight into the path of Reyes. And it was one of those kind of Shearer-like finishes. It just absolutely wellied it into the top of the net, and the whole place went bonkers.
All right, brilliant. In other news, Barcelona beat Real Zaragoza 3-1.
Barcelona didn't win, Messi did. Menez, after the game, said, if we'd had Messi, we'd have won this game. I've said this before, but I think it would be brilliant to watch the Spanish League if we could somehow oblige Messi to go to Valencia and Ronaldo to go to, say, Malaga or Sevilla or Atletico or something. We might then have a really great league with four teams battling out for the title.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. OK, are Barcelona going to beat Spartak Moscow at Spartak Moscow?
Well, you would think so, but not necessarily. I mean, they've not always had it easy when they've travelled away in the Champions League. Until this season, their away record, I must confess, I haven't got the stats in front of me, but I think they'd only won one of something like 7 or 8 away. Really not a great record. Tended to get draws. Having lost to Celtic, of course, it makes things a little bit more difficult for them, but they'll still be favourites. And the good news is that Cesc Fabregas will be there, despite having been held up for 2 hours at the airport because he didn't have his visa with him.
All right. Of course, if Spartak don't beat Barca, a draw could be enough for Celtic in their game away in Lisbon against Benfica. City, of course, where they have happy precedence back in 1967, but have lost on their last 3 visits. Just thought I'd throw that one in. Interesting. Celtic did win in Moscow earlier on in the group stages. Yeah, good. I'm just being stared at by Barry. Yeah.
No, I know. I know what you're doing.
Yeah. What's that?
A certain bass playing former Commotion and Guardian golf writer complained that you were being smug and lazy while discussing Celtic before their game against Barcelona.
Yes.
And now you're trying to show that you've actually done some
homework.
I'm
working hard at being smug now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no. Barry's the wrong man to ask, considering he's just spent a little period of time doing a quite remarkable doodle. I'm sorry, this is not an interactive pod for everyone to see, which I guess you can only describe as possibly another creation for a Roberto Mancini mask.
Oh, what's it look like?
Well,
can you share it with the rest?
It's got Fanny Jeffers' ears and it's got some pimples.
Oh, wow. That's extraordinary, Barry.
Thanks.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry about this, Sid. And look forward to catching up with you and getting the Spanish reaction on Thursday.
Okie dokie. Speak to you then.
Super. Big game for Celtic, Barry?
Yes.
Good.
Their destiny is very much in their own hands, and a draw could be good enough. A win will definitely see them through to the last 16.
Remarkable. Remarkable stuff. Other games, Zenit, opposition goalie hitting with flair, Zenit St. Petersburg, are at home to Malaga, while Milan, still trying to make it out of the group, are going to be at Anderlecht. El Sharaway, young 20-year-old El Sharaway, now top scorer in Serie A with his 10 goals. He's got a brace away to Napoli. Terrific stuff. Dynamo Kiev taking on Paris Saint-Germain. Ooh, Paris Saint-Germain crisis. You mentioned the Rennes business. Extraordinary. They're doing awful. Ever since Ibrahimovic went out of the team because he got suspended in that for karate kicking, kung fu kicking, a goalkeeper, they've been absolutely rotten. They got a draw at Montpellier and then they lose to a team with just 9 men. And Carlo Ancelotti said it is crisis. And everybody's saying, what kind of... Sorry, Amy.
Yeah, no, I was just astonished to see that remark from Ancelotti. Mm. I mean, it's still fairly early days in the season. If you look at the top of Ligue 1, I think there's 6 teams separated by 3 points.
Teams separated by 3 points,
well,
yeah. Rennes are the team in 7th place.
Considering they're within that grouping, I wouldn't say it's quite a crisis yet.
Mm. Lyon are the new leaders there, but it's just when you look at how much money they've spent compared to the rest of the league, even losing Ibrahimovic, you'd think they might be able to put together some form of performance, but again, questions being asked about the character of the team.
Which ex-Premier League player plays for Lyon? Steed Malbronk.
There you go. And he's playing very well for them, isn't he? There we go. Right. In other news, not necessarily related to Champions League, Genoa Derby in Italy saw a team fresh from 7 straight defeats take on a team fresh from 5 straight defeats. The former team, Sampdoria, won 3-1, which means that Gigi Del Neri, since arriving on the Genoa bench, has now racked up 5 straight defeats, because they've now had 6 and he came in after one of them. Yeah. Which, knowing the way Genoa fans behave, promises trouble this week, wouldn't you say, Greg?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, maybe they'll have a pep talk from their ultras.
Of course, it was last season that Genoa fans shocked football by halting the game and demanding the players hand over their jerseys because they weren't worthy to wear them. Mm. Anyway, so yeah, it could be an interesting week that in Genoa. In the Championship, how's Mick McCarthy doing at Ipswich, Barry?
Very well. I think since he's arrived there, they've been beaten, was it 5-1 and now 6-1?
5-0 at Palace.
5-0, sorry.
Yeah, and now 6-0 at Leicester.
Oh, God, I've given them 2 goals. Yep. They didn't even score. I was being overly kind. Yeah, they've had one decent result, though, I think. So I think he's still in the early stages so that he can blame it all on being Paul Jewell's team and not his fault.
Okay.
But yeah, he probably needs to get his finger out pretty quickly.
Meantime, Palace, with their new manager, are still top of the table with 3-0 win against Derby. Cardiff second, who beat Borough. That was a big win. Certainly was. Stuart Downing, some suggestions Stuart Downing might be heading back to Borough.
There have been suggestions that he could go back to Borough because... it's pretty clear he's not wanted at Liverpool, and now that Jose Enrique has sort of taken over in his position and scored a goal, I'd say he'll be rushed to the exit door sooner rather than later.
Right, okay. League 2, Barnet are out of the relegation zone after a 1-1 draw with Accrington, featuring a red card for Edgar Davids. How about that? Not sure if it was the turning point in that draw, but anyway, Edgar Davids and Barnet out of trouble at the bottom of League 2. Good. Now, in a minute or two, we're going to be talking about other Premier League news, that drama at Loftus Road, and music in football. world of internet sports reporting is agog at word that Snoop Dogg wants to buy into Celtic. We've got music and football's Michael Hann here. Michael, what's the latest?
The latest on Snoop Dogg wanting to buy
Snoop Lion.
Snoop Lion. So yep. It's going to be Snoop Tiger by this evening. The latest is I have no idea, James.
Him
can
and
I be
Apple
more
are on a kind
that?
Of convergent path. They're not vis-a-vis their upgrades. Snoop, but he's basically just, you know, he's... You know,
it's rubbish. Of course it's rubbish.
It's rubbish. Everyone's
Snoop Lion.
Some great quotes in there, though, about him, about his boy David Beckham, and they have lunch, and he's going to...
Well, Snoop does have an interest in football.
Yeah.
Part of his rider, whenever he plays anywhere, is that a shirt from the local soccer team must be made available. So when he played at the Forum, the promoter's actually a QPR fan and supplied him with a QPR shirt to wear on stage.
Do you know, here's a curiosity for you. Do you know what shirt he wore when he played at Lovebox in East London last year?
No, James, I don't. Are you going to tell us?
I certainly am. It was an ice hockey shirt from Lee Valley's Eastern Stars.
Well, he's a man who loves his sport.
Right.
But the music and football ownership thing I would like to see would actually be a QPR fan, Pete Doherty, buying into Chelsea.
Right.
And seeing all the money that Roman Abramovich has spunked on heroin and not on players. That's the only thing that can bring me any cheer this season.
I believe somebody once appeared in a Snoop Dogg video wearing an Offaly hurling jersey. They're my local team in Ireland.
Really?
Which is rather remarkable, yeah.
That would be quite random.
And Snoop Dogg also said his favourite player, he thinks Georgios Samaras is a bit special, which would suggest to me that he may have been smoking a rather large bifter shortly before his interview with the Daily Record.
He saw some of that Celtic-Barcelona game and... He knows that, in his words, I know that Barcelona are a big deal, and it shows Celtic are a big deal as well. I'm really resisting the temptation to bust out my Snoop impression.
Go on.
Wisely,
go on,
I'm not going
go
to.
On.
I'm so
oh, go on.
Faux shizzle, James, please.
No. Anyway, moving along. So, yeah, so Samaras, that's a good shout. Big player for them. We certainly haven't made fun of him in the past. Music and football. It's a heady kind of cocktail, isn't it, of divergent interests.
Where are you going with that?
Well, P. Diddy once expressed an interest in buying Crystal Palace.
P. Diddy once reported as an expressing an interest in buying Crystal Palace, which isn't quite the same thing.
Well, you haven't come to play, have you?
Well, come on. We shouldn't dignify this kind of crap with proper responses, should we,
right,
really?
Then. Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm letting Ben down here, aren't I?
You are a bit.
He did tell me music and football.
Music and football. Clint Dempsey. I
rapper.
Make the game ferocious. I got that from my coaches.
Have you seen the video for Clint Dempsey's
single? I have.
It's extraordinary, isn't
good.
It? Yeah.
Yep.
He hasn't made too many games ferocious since he went to Tottenham.
That's true. He hasn't made many singles of late either. Mm. Perhaps there's a connection. And Djibril Cisse, I can't believe the lyrics that producer Ben has supplied from his single in 2006 called Shake My Play Mo Bitch.
That's what he was saying on Twitter on Saturday night when he was offering QPR fans outside.
Ah!
Although he has since taken those tweets down.
Is he? Ain't nothing start fucking, let's get this party jumping. Shocking rhymes, really. Michael, you mentioned QPR, we weren't going to bring it up.
Yes, you were, that's why you invited me on.
Well, it might be. Saints, they're fun, aren't they? They're an enjoyable team, entertaining.
They played well on Saturday, although I stand by my assertion a few weeks ago that the odd good game isn't enough to keep you up. I still think they're going to struggle. But
that's
frankly,
true.
I could put out a team made up of my son, my daughter, and 9 other kids plucked off the streets of North London, and they would beat QPR at the moment.
Really? Well, yeah. Now, Mark Hughes can't understand it. Can you offer him any pointers?
Well, one of the most worrying things at QPR at the moment is the lack of understanding of the whole coaching team about what's going on. Mark Bowen appeared on the Open All Ours podcast the other week, and he was saying, we don't know why we're losing. We have no idea why we're losing. The team are prepared meticulously. Well, they say that, but for a meticulously prepared team, I dread to think what a team that was badly prepared would look like. Take a couple of games at the start of October against West Ham and West Brom, both teams playing 3 strong, big central midfielders, and QPR went with 2 central midfielders and 2 wide and got completely outplayed in the centre of the park, surrendered both games. Now, is that meticulous preparation? The other thing is, in most other games, QPR actually play some pretty stuff in the middle third of the pitch, but hopeless at either end. They don't break. Good teams break quickly and in numbers. QPR breaks slowly, and either in singles or in pairs. The failure to defend any balls coming into the box. This does not speak of preparation. I think it's possible that the players don't want to play for Hughes. I mean, one hears things... Well, here's rumours, some which, of course, are just, you know, rubbish, some of which, though, are really quite well-sourced about the atmosphere at the training ground, about players not being able to get out of training quick enough, about Hughes not wanting to have anything to do with what happens on the training pitch. Not that unusual in a manager, of course. Mm. They often leave it up to coaches. But Hughes reportedly, according to some rumours, completely shying away from confrontation with some of the players who clearly do need to be confronted. And then there's the baffling transfer policy with, you know, dozens of midfielders, many of whom are pretty good. Bowen, again, on the Open All Hours podcast, admitted that the first choice 11 would actually be 12 players to accommodate the midfielders they want to play. Hmm. Well, what about the central defence? What about the attackers? The 25 named three strikers, Cissé, Zamora and Johnson. Two of those are now out with long-term injuries, leaving us with Cissé, who you've never seen a player look less interested in playing for a team at the moment. Oh, no, you have. Jose Boswinger. Sorry. And yet, to DJ Campbell, who is a QPR supporter and wants to play for Queen's Park Rangers, has been shunted out to Ipswich, where he's scoring a goal every other game in a terrible team. It's just...
But apart
it's
mystifying.
From that... Apart from that, but Hughes has been infuriating. His abrogation of all responsibility. I'm sorry you started me. I'm going to be going for about an hour and a half.
Well, you were there at the game. Was that you holding up the banner saying, Harry, come and save us?
It wasn't. I don't want Harry. I really don't want Harry.
Just stop you a minute, Michael. About 14 months ago, I think it was, or something, when Neil Warnock went, I remember we were in this podcast, and I suggested that Rafa Benitez might be a good manager, and you just said, oh, we wouldn't want Rafa Benitez at QPR playing that kind of football. Now, there's a man who is all about preparation and would have been a great manager. Do you not think now you'd be a little bit more keen for...
Well, now being linked with Rafa, but isn't one of the issues with Rafa is falling out with his first team coach, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, since when he's achieved almost nothing?
I think if you hear him talk about football, everything he did at Liverpool, even whether it was with Ayseran or not, I mean, he is a manager who is all about the detail, and I think, you know, he made a Liverpool team, which he didn't have always an awful lot of money to spend, play above themselves, and I imagine he could do a very good job that QPR could have done when they had the money to spend as well.
They did have a chance to get back into this game with the goal just after half time.
They got,
huh?
The goal,
yeah,
and then they stopped playing again.
Is the issue that you talk about the foreign, or the imports that come in, and people questioning whether they really want to play? Should they maybe have kept hold of some of last year's players? Would a certain Joey Barton have made?
No, not Barton. One of the things for Hughes, I mean, people always talk about, isn't it an amazing achievement of Alex Ferguson? He built two title-winning teams. QPR have built four teams in the last 2 years. Warnock's promotion-winning team, Warnock's first Premier League team, then Hughes with his wholesale replacements, another Premier League team. Now, the fourth, few second Premier League team. Now, it's just extraordinary. Now, there are good players there, but I think what was quite telling on Saturday was Granero, who I think is a lovely player, but was played out wide on the right for no apparent reason. And towards the end of the game, Hughes and his coaching team were bellowing at Granero to go short for corners we were defending to close down the two men. And Granero was just ignoring them. There's no way he wasn't hearing them from 25 yards away. But Granero had just had no interest in what Hughes was saying at all.
It's a very interesting point. So in a sense, Mark Hughes is much better than Sir Alex Ferguson, because Sir Alex Ferguson only built two sides that take him to the championship, whereas Mark Hughes has got four that look very capable of doing that. Amy, your family is full of Rangers fans,
huh? Yes, they were really thrilled this weekend as well, Michael. In fact, my brother is overseas at the minute, and I was overhearing a phone call between my dad, who'd been at the game, and my brother, and he was sort of explaining what was going on, and was... He sort of summed up the mood by saying that he and all his pals who have been watching QPR for hundreds of years were all thinking of getting Millwall season tickets next year. So that kind of rammed home to me the fact that things really are pretty bad. And my dad and some of his buddies...
Millwall?
They were sort of lamenting at the end of the game, trying to put some context into exactly what they were watching this season. And it was their valued opinion. And none of these are spring chickens, my dad and his mates who go and watch QPR, that they don't remember ever seeing a sort of period of games, 12 matches or 3 months or however you want to define it, ever in any division where QPR have been quite so bad over a long period of time. And I think when you're faced with that kind of situation, it's, you know, there's really no other alternative except a change.
The issue isn't is there anyone better than Mark Hughes? The point is now, and the problem for him is that there is no one who could possibly do worse. But Dave McIntyre, the journalist who he has a website, West London Sport, he's watched and reports on QPR for a long time. He consistently makes the interesting argument that it's pointless blaming Hughes. The culture at the club has been set by Fernandez. Fernandez and a load of people who have no experience in football came in, started running the club, and demanded this kind of starry approach to the game. And he reckons it's Fernandez, who is still beloved by the fans just about, who has ripped the heart from the club. And the players are reflecting that. They're playing for a club with no culture, no soul, no heart. Why would they turn up and do anything?
So who do you want? You say you don't want Harry, you don't want Rafa.
As I say, it doesn't really matter anymore. Anyone, James, Barry, even Barry. No, I would love to see you.
I could do a worse job than Mark Hughes. I guarantee you that if I got the QPR job, they would be relegated by the middle of February.
Well, I think we have to work on the assumption that Rangers are getting relegated. So I think the starry manager is actually not the right option. I would love to see, say, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer given a try in English football. But I think Rafa, all those managers who are about stardom, are probably not the right fit at the moment. QPR is a small club.
Am I right to think, Michael, you're a young fella, is sort of around, he's on his first or second season ticket. Do you not think this is a good grounding for him of what to expect later in life, crushing, relentless disappointment?
I apologised to him on Saturday night for making him a QPR fan, and then I spent the rest of Saturday night imagining Mark Hughes' response to events in history. You know, Agincourt, well, the press will concentrate, wrongly and unfairly in my view, on the English archers. But from my point of view, there was some good close fighting. Mark Hughes on Stalingrad. Well, we were undone by one lucky Russian winter, but I'm still confident we can take Moscow. You know, just, oh, get lost, Hughes.
My word. Okay, well, currently QPR are 5 points away from safety, but there are a lot of bad teams out there, Michael.
There are a lot of bad teams out there, and QPR on paper should be much, much better than them, but sadly we play on grass.
All right, well, so Whitehaven, of course, didn't help that Reading finally got a win this weekend out. And I don't know how they did it. How did they get this win at home to Everton? Everton have only had one win in six now.
They got two goals and Everton only got one goal.
Oh, right. And they just did it on a straight goal count.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, then. And, well done to Reading.
Yeah, I didn't see this.
No, I
didn't see it, like, anything to do with this. So
all right. Well,
Adam
sorry.
Fondra, that's the key.
My brother saw this game. Yeah. He was there. He came away saying, I don't know how we won that game. But if you'd been there to explain about this goals business, that would have put his mind at rest. There you go.
That's your brother, the BBC journalist, Gary.
No.
Or your other brother.
Exactly, my other brother. Yeah. Okay. Well, fascinating. Michael, I'm awfully sorry that the times remain so tough, although it does make a terrific story. And well done to Saints.
It does matter. Yeah, I really should take nothing away from Southampton, who really played very, very well on Saturday. But they played like a team, which is exactly what QPR aren't. Or rather, QPR are like a team, but as Dave Thomas pointed out in the Kick Up the Arse fanzine on Saturday, they play like an exhibition team, not like a Premier League team.
Right. All right. Well, that is... who have you got next?
Oh, that's going to be fine away at Old Trafford on Saturday.
Oof.
The Man United fans are already besieging social media, demanding that Mark Hughes be kept in the job because they're confident they'll run up near cricket scores against QPR if he is.
Wow. All right, then. Well, listen, best of luck with the rest of the season. Thanks very much for joining us today. We didn't mention Liverpool-Wigan or the fact that Suarez is a top scorer.
Yeah, Suarez was fantastic. Brendan Rodgers flipped the triangle. That was his tactical move this time.
He flipped the triangle?
He flipped the triangle.
Isn't that something Snoop Dogg does?
I think it's an offensive American hand gesture, which Rodgers did after 33 minutes when he took Souza off and put Henderson on, which is what he did. And and Liverpool dominated the second half and played very well.
And in other news, Swansea, big win for them away to Newcastle. They've lost their last two at home. Of course, Liverpool have young boys in Europa League, and Newcastle are at home to Maritimo. Interesting. Yeah, Swansea are all the way up in 10th place now. Well done to Michael Laudrup. And that brings us to the end of today's pod. We'll be back on Thursday with a reaction to the Champions League and much, much more. Thanks for being with us, Michael Hann, Greg Bukowski, Amy Lawrence, and Barry Glendinning, and you, producer Ben. And have a super week. We'll speak to you on Thursday.